C.H. Tetons writes as follows of the Naumann coup attempt. Late on the night of January 14, 1953, the telephones rang in the homes of newspaper correspondents representing the foreign press in London. The sleepy newsmen, responding to the calls, were requested by a Foreign Office official to assemble at Downing Street by 7 o'clock the following morning for an important press conference. There was little doubt that something extraordinary had happened, since it was the first time since the end of the war that a news conference had been scheduled for such an unusual hour. The next morning, shortly after 7, the head of the press division of the Foreign Office, Sir William Ridsdale, R-I-D-S-D-A-L-E, distributed a communique which stated that a group of 7 former high Nazi officials had been arrested in Dusseldorf and Hamburg for having plotted the overthrow of the Bonn Republic. The official announcement said that the British authorities had been aware for some time that the 7 men had been involved in a plot and that the arrest had been made under the authority of Foreign Minister Anthony Eden. The ringleader of the group was a Dr. Werner Naumann, N-A-U-M-A-N-N, who until the German collapse had served as State Secretary in Dr. Goebbels' propaganda ministry. Dr. Naumann had been with Hitler during the very last days in the bunker of the Chancellery in Berlin, and he was the one designated by the Führer in his testament to succeed Dr. Goebbels as propaganda minister. Last sentence again. Dr. Naumann had been with Hitler during the very last days in the bunker of the Chancellery in Berlin, and he was the one designated by the Führer in his testament to succeed Dr. Goebbels as propaganda minister. Arrested along with Naumann were the following prominent Nazis. Karl Kaufmann, K-A-U-F-M-A-N-N, one-time Gauleiter of Hamburg, Paul Zimmermann, Z-I-M-M-E-R-M-A-N-N, an SS general, and an official of the concentration camp branch of the SS organization, Gustav Scheel, S-C-H-E-E-L, Gauleiter of Salzburg, Austria, and designated Minister of Education in Hitler's will, Dr. Heinrich Hasselmeier, head of the National Socialist Student League, and Hitler's, quote, expert on race and sterilization, unquote. Last name, H-A-S-E-L-M-E-Y-E-R. Dr. Carl Scharping, S-C-H-A-R-P-I-N-G, a propaganda official under Dr. Goebbels. Heinz Siepen, oh, by the way, Scharping, S-C-H-A-R-P-I-N-G, Heinz Siepen, S-I-E-P-E-N, another district leader of the Third Reich. The British announced that they had confiscated, quote, tons of material, unquote, 4 truckloads, and after the first check, they hinted that a careful examination would produce ample evidence to back up an indictment of conspiracy and high treason. The 7 arrested men were described as the leaders of a group of 125 important Nazis, whose aim was to infiltrate the 3 rightist parties in the Adenauer coalition. Their final goal had been, quote, the overthrow of the Bonn parliamentary regime, unquote. The arrest of the plotters had a strong effect upon the Bonn government and on German public opinion. According to a dispatch in the New York Times, Chancellor Adenauer was, quote, shocked and angered, unquote. The Times, quoting from the Generalanzeiger of Bonn, a paper close to Adenauer, said that the British, quote, had contrived the whole affair for the purpose of warning the Americans against entering a direct alliance with the dangerous Germans, unquote. By the way, the Generalanzeiger is G-E-N-E-R-A-L-A-N-Z-E-I-G-E-R. Times correspondent, this New York Times, by the way, Times correspondent Drew Middleton reported from Bonn that, quote, the German public sentiment began to crystallize in defense of the 7 arrested National Socialists, unquote. Leading Bonn officials and politicians, supported by the majority of the German press, opened an all-out campaign against the British, implying that they had sinister motives and telling them that they had no business poking into a strictly domestic German affair. Only a handful of Democratic and conservative papers took a more critical view of the Naumann conspiracy. By the way, in an asterisk, Tetons writes, although this information is based upon a collection of several hundred dispatches and editorials, I have drawn chiefly on the reports from the New York Times of January 16th to 18th, 1953. Also of special significance were several articles which appeared in the Frankfurter Rundschau and the Stuttgarter Nachrichten during the latter part of January 1953, revealing the magnitude of the Naumann plot. By the way, Frankfurter Rundschau, F-R-A-N-K-F-U-R-T-E-R, RUNDSCHAU, and Stuttgarter Nachrichten, STUTTGARTER, NACHRICHTEN. Now note again that German public opinion has crystallized against the British, and the Adenauer government itself is condemning the British here for their actions in arresting these plotters. Note that not only was Naumann designated to succeed Goebbels by Hitler in his will, but that also these other high Nazi officials, including Gustav Scheel, was designated Minister of Education in Hitler's will. So these are the designated successors of Adolf Hitler. Now, in noting the outcry by both the Adenauer government, the supposed, quote, new, unquote, German government, and the German people against the British arrest of the coup plotters, we are now going to see what the basic rub was, so to speak, why they were outraged at the British, and what they were charging, at least publicly, that the British were going to do. Now, again, this is, for those who hear the program on tape, this is September 20th, 1992. On this date, the French have narrowly voted to ratify the Maastricht Treaty, which will unify Germany, and will or unify Europe, I should say, Freudian slip, and will provide for an all-European currency by 1999. The European Union, which at some point figures to include the former Warsaw Pact countries as well as the now independent republics of the former Soviet Union, will become by far and away the most powerful political and in particular economic entity on the face of the earth. And unified Europe is, and in all probability for a long time, will be dominated by Germany, and its economic affairs dominated by the German mark. And again, for the people who eventually hear this on tape, in the past week or two, there have been some very frightening fluctuations in the European currencies and some very frightening developments in the world's capital markets as a result of the Germans' refusal to lower their interest rates past the quarter of a point lowering that they have, they've agreed to. And the mark at this point is by far and away the strongest currency in the world, certainly a whole lot stronger than the dollar and a whole lot stronger than the lira. And so note again that in 1992, some events that we're going to look at here have come to fruition. And when I speak of the United States again as having lost the Second World War, we're talking about a political and consequent economic defeat, not a military defeat, but that defeat accomplished through the establishment of the Christian West concept, the adoption of liberation theory, its ascension as a result of a number of events, including the assassination of John Kennedy after it had become a major political force as well as a strategic force, and the ultimate ascension, the triumph, I should say, of liberation theory, originally a Third Reich tactic, in the Reagan and Bush administrations, and the projection of many of the Galen and SS-related elements into positions of activism in the former Warsaw Pact states and the former Soviet Union. In some of those areas, they are now ascendant. They are triumphant. Returning again to the reasons behind the German protest against the British arrest of the Naumann coup plotters, the main concern of German government officials and the press was that the British had acted, quote, unfairly, unquote, against Bonn at a moment when Dr. Adenauer had to face a most delicate international situation. At that time, the Adenauer cabinet hoped for a speedy ratification of the European Defense Community Treaty, or EDC, which would restore full German sovereignty and would be the first step toward political unification of Europe. Again, at that time, the Adenauer cabinet hoped for a speedy ratification of the European Defense Community Treaty, or EDC, which would restore full German sovereignty and would be the first step toward political unification of Europe. To raise the specter of a resurgent Nazi danger before world opinion at such a time, at such a moment, was, in Dr. Adenauer's eyes, an unpardonable crime. Last sentence again. To raise the specter of a resurgent Nazi danger before world opinion at such a time, at such a moment, was in Dr. Adenauer's eyes an unpardonable crime. The Chancellor was especially bitter because the British High Commissioner, Sir Yvonne Kirkpatrick, had not consulted him before the arrest. That's Ivone Kirkpatrick. Continuing. The British reply was polite, but determined. It pointed out that the occupation authorities had been profoundly disturbed when they had found evidence of an advanced plot instigated by a vast Nazi network spreading from Dusseldorf to Cairo, Madrid, Buenos Aires, and Malmo, Sweden. Malmo, M-A-L-M-O, umlaut over the O. Again, take note of this advanced Nazi plot and where it spreads, the areas it covers. It pointed out that the occupation authorities had been profoundly disturbed when they had found evidence of an advanced plot instigated by a vast Nazi network spreading from Dusseldorf to Cairo, Madrid, Buenos Aires, and Malmo, Sweden. They stated furthermore that they had had to proceed with the utmost secrecy since the plotters had close contacts with high government circles in Bonn. Again, they stated furthermore that they had had to proceed with the utmost secrecy since the plotters had close contacts with high government circles in Bonn. Bear in mind again that in 1944, Kurt Ries was writing about the plans to have both the Nazi Party and the German government go underground in cellular organizations, and to have the German government organized, the German government cells, the government cells, I should say, organized in cells with an A man and a B man, the A man, to maintain contact with government higher ups, and the B man to be in touch with the Nazi Party, the underground part of the organization. And as we're going to see, those A men were in very, very, very close contact with the Adenauer government and the higher-ups in that particular government. Returning again, now bear in mind that was 44, we're going to return again to 1953 as related in a book published in 1961. According to the New York Times, the British submitted evidence to the Chancellor which, quote, revealed a widespread plot with ramifications into many political parties and other influential organizations of West Germany, unquote. Faced with the grave implications of the Naumann conspiracy, Dr. Adenauer and his Minister of Justice, Dr. Thomas Dehler, D-E-H-L-E-R, had to confirm the seriousness of the case. After the British had convinced Dr. Adenauer that they had an open and shut case against the Naumann plotters, the Bonn government suddenly exerted great pressure to bring the proceedings under German jurisdiction. Again, after the British had convinced Dr. Adenauer that they had an open and shut case against the Naumann plotters, the Bonn government suddenly exerted great pressure to bring the proceedings under German jurisdiction. On March 13, 1953, Dr. Adenauer wrote a letter to the British High Commissioner asking, quote, that the investigation and eventual prosecution of Dr. Naumann and his associates should be handed over to the German authorities, unquote. The British responded favorably to this request on March 26, 1953. After taking over the investigation, Dr. Adenauer admitted at a press conference, quote, the existence of a far-flung plot, unquote, and that Naumann's activities, quote, had been financed with considerable sums by Nazi groups in foreign countries. Again, quote, Naumann's activities had, quote, been financed with considerable sums by Nazi groups in foreign countries, unquote. Again, remember the role of the projected role of the Ausland Organisation and the projected role of Latin America, including Argentina, among other places, in the post-World War II underground Reich. Continuing with T.H. Tetten's text here. Minister of Justice Dehler told reporters that the Naumann group had developed, quote, a most cunning and diabolic system of infiltration, unquote, and that the conspiracy represented, again quoting, an acute threat to the democratic institutions in the Federal Republic, unquote. The captured Naumann documents, he said, again quoting, gave clear proof that the aim of the group had been to fill key positions in all rightist parties with hardcore Nazis and thereby create propaganda vehicles which later could be used for a broad neo-Nazi mass movement. And again, note here that this is supposedly a frustrated coup, the aims of which, quote, gave clear proof that the aim of the group had been to fill key positions in all rightist parties with hardcore Nazis and thereby create propaganda vehicles which later could be used for a broad neo-Nazi mass movement, unquote. As we'll see later on in this series, they did exactly that. In fact, we're going to see pretty firm indications of that this evening, continuing but with Tetten's account. According to the Wiesbadener Courier of May 6, 1953, Dr. Daler quoted from one document in which Naumann expressed the hope that, if his scheme succeeded, quote, the coming election might be the last of its kind, unquote. The Wiesbadener Courier, WYESBADENERKURIER. Now, we're going to see next what happened after the British agreed to transfer prosecution of the Naumann case to the German authorities. And recall again that the Germans, including the Adenauer government, rallied behind the plotters because they felt that this was simply a British conspiracy to warn Washington against an alliance with the dangerous Germans, and that beyond that, this jeopardized the ratification of the European Defense Community Treaty, which would restore full German sovereignty, and that that would be the first step toward political unification of Europe, which almost 40 years after the Naumann coup in 1992 has now basically been achieved. And of the Germans' curious handling of the Naumann plotters, Tettens writes as follows. Soon after the British had transferred the prosecution of the case to the German authorities, the lawyers of the arrested plotters began to put pressure on the federal government to suppress the case and release their clients. The Bremer Nachrichten reported on June 15, 1953, that the Naumann lawyers had even threatened to discuss, quote, the true background of the case openly, unquote, if their clients were not released soon. Now, note here again that the Naumann lawyers were threatening to discuss, quote, the true background of the case openly, unquote, if their clients were not released soon. As we'll see later, the Naumann plotters had some very, very tight leashes on the Adenauer government, and beyond that, the German government, all facets of the German government. Continuing with Tettens' account, by the end of June 1953, Dr. Naumann and his co-plotters were suddenly released in violation of the most rigid stipulations of German law and court procedure. A year and a half later, in December 1954, in spite of the fact that the prosecutor had brought an indictment against Naumann charging conspiracy against the Constitution of the Federal Republic, the highest court quietly dismissed the case without any trial or hearing. Again, the plotters were not only released, the case against them was dismissed by the highest court in West Germany in December of 54. In future installments of RFA 37, we're going to take a look at the complete reinstitution of the Third Reich judicial system in post-World War II Germany, in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. Recall that in RFA number 2, part of which was replayed last week, we took a look at how in 1981, the Reichstag fire verdict became official unchallengeable German law. Continuing now with Tettens' account, even before the plotters were released, the British became suspicious about the handling of the Naumann case and leaked some of the incriminating material to a staunchly democratic German newspaper, which had gained quite a reputation for its revealing articles on the infiltration of former Nazis into the Adenauer administration. During the early part of June 1953, the Frankfurter Rundschau published 5 articles dealing with Naumann's tapped telephone conversations, notes from his appointment calendar, correspondence between the plotters, and significant excerpts from his diary. The published material gave a full, inside view of the scope and character of the conspiracy. The description of the intricate structure of the plot and the background of the many people involved filled whole pages in the Frankfurter Rundschau. Here, it is sufficient to state the main objectives as they emerge from the confiscated material. And again, this from documents taken from the Naumann plotters, as well as from material taken from phone taps. 1. Use the democratic constitution as a facade behind which a new Nazi movement could be organized, designed to take over the apparatus of the state when time and circumstances would make such a step necessary and profitable. 2. Let Chancellor Adenauer serve as a front, exactly as Gustav Stresemann did during the 20s, behind which a new German power could develop undisturbed without arousing premature suspicions. Stresemann, by the way, Stresemann. 3. Apply a new method of infiltration, Unterwanderung, in order to conquer the existing parties and the administrative machinery of the state from within. Unterwanderung is Unterwanderung. And again, note that they are going to try and conquer the existing parties and the administrative machinery of the state from within the success they enjoyed we're going to see both this evening and in future installments. Avoid noisy nationalistic demonstrations, flag-waving, and incidents. Use the more efficient and unsuspicious procedure of working in small cells, which someday, at an opportune moment, might consolidate themselves into a broad mass organization. Note this last sentence. Does this have a familiar ring to it? Now, again, we're talking about 1953, as reported in a book in 1961 by one of the foremost authorities on Pan-Germanism in the Third Reich. Avoid noisy nationalistic demonstrations, flag-waving, and incidents. Use the more efficient and unsuspicious procedure of working in small cells, which someday, at an opportune moment, might consolidate themselves into a broad mass organization. Obviously, we are seeing here in the Naumann coup of 53 the use of the very cells which we saw being put together in 1944. Continuing, the detailed plan, which the Germans soon called the Now-Now strategy, instructed former well-known Nazi leaders to stay discreetly in the background until the time was ripe for action. In the meantime, the leaders were to use all their connections to bring bright and capable young Nazis, especially those trained in the Hitler Youth, into influential positions not only in the Adenauer coalition parties, but also into all other political organizations. The Naumann documents revealed much more than a mere strategic blueprint of how to subvert a state apparatus or the existing parties from within. There was a detailed record of how Dr. Naumann had used his contacts with top industrialists and leading politicians to fill well-paid positions in the Free Democratic Party with scores of young, able Nazis who once had learned the tricks of the trade in the Goebbels propaganda ministry. Now bear in mind that as we took a look at in The Nazis Go Underground, that ministry was dissolved. But obviously Dr. Werner Naumann, designated in Hitler's will to succeed Joseph Goebbels, was able to resurrect that, at least in an underground fashion. Note again now that the program for having the German government undergo underground where that was to have two-man cells, an A-man and a B-man, the A-man maintaining contact with the higher-ups in the German government, the B-man with the underground Nazi party, the illegal part of the movement. And recall again that last week we took a look at the reinstitution of all of the Third Reich and the major Third Reich industrialists and financiers, all of the important ones, at the end of World War II due to the good graces of their American counterparts, who together, the Americans and the Germans, formed the main elements of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I have spoken about. And again, I want to reiterate that it is the industrialists, both the pro-Nazi and non-ideological collaborators in the United States, as well as their German counterparts, who form the real foundation of the events that I'm describing here in Radio Free America 37. Just as we took a look at Alan Dulles negotiating with people like Giro von Gebernitz, so again, the reinstitution of these Nazi industrialists and financiers in the quote new unquote Germany provided in many ways the foundation for the Naumann group and the underground Nazi apparatus to be able to successfully fulfill its work. And note again the A-man, B-man cell system of the underground German government and the contacts of the Naumann group with top industrialists and leading politicians, using these to fill well-paid positions in the Free Democratic Party with scores of young, and again quoting here, let me quote again directly, there was a detailed record of how Dr. Naumann had used his contacts with top industrialists and leading politicians to fill well-paid positions in the Free Democratic Party with scores of young, able Nazis who once had learned the tricks of the trade in the Goebbels propaganda ministry. Dr. Naumann's most devoted collaborator in this enterprise was his intimate friend Dr. Ernst Achenbach, A-C-H-E-N-B-A-C-H, a former Ribbentrop diplomat who, after the war, had become a prominent lawyer in the Ruhr district. It was reported that Achenbach and Naumann had been close friends during the war when they served together in important positions under Ambassador Otto Abetz, A-B-E-T-Z, in the German embassy in occupied Paris. It was Dr. Achenbach who in 1943 recommended to the Foreign Office that 2,000 Jews be shipped to the East as reprisal for an attack on two Nazi officers. After the war, Achenbach aggressively defended Nazi notables in many war crime trials. In later years, he became the legal counselor and political confidant of a group of right-wing Ruhr industrialists. So again, note the key position of the industrialists here. With the financial power of the industrial giants of the Ruhr behind him, Achenbach exerted a dominating influence in the Free Democratic Party, where he held the important position of chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. Many of his close friends and connections, mainly young Nazi activists, had successfully infiltrated the two other Adenauer coalition parties, the ultra-rightist German Party and the All-German Bloc or Refugee Party, the latter appealing chiefly to the 10 million refugees from the Eastern Territories. For some time after his arrest, the British kept Dr. Naumann incommunicado because they regarded his lawyer, who was Dr. Achenbach, as severely implicated in the plot. The pro-Adenauer paper Stuttgarter Nachrichten of January 17, 1953, named Achenbach the spiritus rector behind the drive toward a neo-Nazi restoration. That's spiritusrector. A lengthy British white paper on the Naumann-Achenbach plot was ready to be released in August of 1953 when it was suddenly, quote, withdrawn at the last moment on cabinet instructions for reasons which never have been made quite clear, unquote. There were rumors that the British had yielded under the combined pressure of Washington and Bonn. Again, note that the British white paper was withdrawn at the last minute, and although it has never been established exactly why that happened, the rumors were combined pressure from Washington and Bonn. Now, bear in mind, again, that one of the underlying strategic and theoretical considerations of RFA 37 was the Nazi tactic of using anti-communism as a vehicle for conquest. One of the reasons why the reinstitution of Third Reich elements in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany is not generally recognized and has not been reported, particularly in this country, is that basically, in the Cold War, with the fear of communism rampant in this country, it became essential, from a propaganda standpoint, to portray the new Germany as a democratic institution and a bulwark against the Soviet-style totalitarianism of East Germany. So anti-communism here was, again, strategically used in a very skillful way to cover up some of the activities, or at least to eclipse some of the activities that I'm describing here and the activities that I will be describing in installments to come. Continuing now, and now we're going to take a look at the actual structure of the Naumann Group and how it related to the decentralized post-World War II Nazi underground. And again, note that we've already seen how cellular organization and infiltration was a major tactic of the Naumann Group. Again, that coup occurred in 53. That reflects directly the projections of Kurt Ries in 1944. Continuing now with T.H. Tetten's from 1961. Of the material that was confiscated from the Naumann plotters, much of it contained in the white paper which was withdrawn, the confiscated material disclosed that the Achenbach-Naumann group represented a so-called Führungsring, F-U-H-R-U-N-G-S-R-N-G, a Nazi high command, a kind of political mafia with headquarters in Madrid, which operated by remote control through clever organizational schemes on different levels, serving various purposes. Again, the confiscated material disclosed that the Achenbach-Naumann group represented a so-called Führungsring, a Nazi high command, a kind of political mafia with headquarters in Madrid, which operated by remote control through clever organizational schemes on different levels, serving various purposes. This Gauleiter group met periodically in the strictest secrecy, mainly in Dusseldorf or Hamburg. Up to 30 former Nazi top officials assembled under false names as, quote, old friends, unquote, in hotels, where they carried on their political scheming. Among them were the ex-Gauleiters Kaufmann, Grohe, Florian, Wegner, Frauenfeld, and Scheel, and a number of high officials from the propaganda ministry, some Ribbentrop diplomats, and top-ranking SS officers, By the way, Kaufman, we've already seen. Grohe, Grohe. Florian, Florian. Wegener, Wegener. Frauenfeld, Frauenfeld. And Shale, we've already seen. Continuing. According to the British correspondent Alistair Horne, H-O-R-N-E, the quote, roll calls of the ex-Gauleiters and high SS officials present read like a page from some nightmare who's who of the Third Reich, unquote. These Nazi leaders had either escaped the dragnet of the victorious Allies by false identification papers or had been released from internment after a year or two without any substantial penalty. The aim of the group was, quote, to form the general staff of the national opposition, unquote, and build, quote, a new political party out of the existing parties of the right, unquote. Besides the infiltration of co-conspirators into positions of command within the existing parties and into government departments and party organizations on the middle and lower levels, another task of the Führungsring was to organize and direct mass organizations such as veterans and refugee associations, which one day could easily be used as instruments for political action. Other fields of activities for the group were political propaganda in foreign countries, carried out in close contact with the Nazi core headquarters in Madrid, and the initiation of conspiracies in foreign markets in behalf of German industrial cartels. So, before we continue with the next section, note that this Führungsring is described as a Nazi high command, a kind of political mafia headquartered, surprise, surprise, in Madrid, which was exactly where Kurt Ries had projected the one of the major operational centers of the post of the decentralized, underground, cellularized post-World War II Nazi underground. And note the description here, with a kind of political mafia with headquarters in Madrid, which operated by remote control through clever organizational schemes on different levels, serving various purposes. Obviously, what we're looking at here is a realization of the post-World War II plans of the Third Reich to go underground. And skipping down, some of the activities of the tasks of the Führungsring described again, organize and direct mass organizations such as veterans and refugee associations, which one day could easily be used as instruments for political action. Note here the veterans organizations, because we're going to come back to those in connection with the Deutsche Soldatenzeitung, later the Deutsche National Deutsche National Zeitung und Soldatenzeitung. That was the Gerhard Fry paper to which Edwin Walker communicated the information that Lee Harvey Oswald had fired at him. And we're going to touch back again on the significance of that. And also note refugee associations, because both with many of the Vlasov, Galen-related, ABN-related refugees from Eastern Europe who were operating under the Galen organization, as well as from some of the German nationals or people of Germanic extraction who were expelled from some of the former Third Reich territories. We took a look at the Expelle organizations last week, and the cry both by the underground Nazi party in Madrid and the Adenauer government for, quote, liberation, unquote. We're going to take a look at these refugee associations by way of taking a look at liberation thinking or liberation theory in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany at the same time as it was becoming a dominant element of American political thinking in the 1952 campaign. Note here, other activities. Other fields of activities for the group were political propaganda in foreign countries carried out in close contact with the Nazi headquarters in Madrid and the initiation of conspiracies in foreign markets in behalf of German industrial cartels. Note again the very close relationship between the German industrial cartels, which were not disbanded at the end of World War II, as we looked at last week, and the post-World War II activities of this Nazi underground. More about this Nazi underground in exile in Madrid, and again, bear in mind that Kurt Ries in 1944, in his discussion of the Falange and Wilhelm von Vopel, projected Madrid as a major center for the post-World War II decentralized, cellularized Nazi underground. Now, we're going to hear about a fellow named Eugen Dollmann, E-U-G-E-N-D-O-L-L-M-A-N-N. He was a former SS officer who was one of the main couriers and one of the main channels of communication between the various elements of the decentralized post-World War II Nazi underground, this vast Nazi network described in the British communique. Skipping ahead a number of pages in The Nazis Go Underground, after his arrest, the gentleman was really Jürgen Dollmann, born in Regensburg, Bavaria, who had become well known to the security services of almost all European governments. Only 8 months earlier, Herr Dollmann, alias Larcher, L-A-R-C-H-E-R, had been in the headlines all over Europe in connection with deportation proceedings in Switzerland. At that time, the Swiss authorities had discovered the true identity of the, quote, Italian art dealer, unquote. During World War II, Jürgen Dollmann was known as the dashing SS colonel who had played a prominent role as the top agent of Hitler and Himmler in Italy, and, quote, whose talent was more for conspiracy than for serious politics, unquote. The investigation by the Swiss authorities established the fact that the former elite guard officer had lived under a false name for several years in a fashionable villa in the Swiss lake resort Lugano. From there, Dollmann made frequent trips to Germany, Austria, Italy, Spain, and Cairo. The colonel's home in Lugano had been the center of lively traffic by mail and courier with far-flung places in the world. According to press reports, Dollmann's outpost in Switzerland was closely tied to the international Nazi headquarters in Madrid. And note again, far-flung places in the world. Note the Deutsche Heimschule and their role in training Germans not only to go to different places of Nazis to go to different places in Germany than they were natives of, but also to go abroad and become fluent in languages. More about this Nazi government in exile in Madrid, again, just as Kurt Ries had projected in 44. Enough facts are known about the center in Madrid to show that it functions as a Nazi party organization in exile. It has been reported that the Madrid center has its own financial department, sustained by a huge treasure chest which the Nazis shipped to neutral countries before the German collapse. There is a special department for German affairs, departments for Africa and Latin America, and also a unit known as the International of Nationalists. The latter is a propaganda organization with branches all over Europe and groups operating in the Western Hemisphere and on other continents. On May 29, 1951, Times correspondent C.I. Sulzberger confirmed the existence of this group, which had revived the fascist international in various countries, quote, from Malmo to Tangier and from Rome to Buenos Aires, unquote. The Washington Post of May 6, 1956, reported on the close contacts between right-wing radicals in Germany and the center of the Nazi International in Madrid. And note here the fascist international, jumping ahead even further from this T.H. Tetten's book in 1961, describing events in the early and mid-50s. Something that we have discussed in numerous Radio Free America broadcasts, beginning in RFA number 4, coming back in Radio Free America program numbers, well, I'm not sure we discussed it in 14 or 15, but certainly in Radio Free America program number 27 and other Radio Free America broadcasts, we have taken a look at what Henrik Krüger in The Great Heroin Coup published in 1980 termed the Internacional Fascista. And this, again, was a Spanish, Italian, German, and Latin American fascist international, again, an Internacional Fascista, being run by, among others, Otto Skorzeny, who was described at the time in this particular account by Henrik Krüger in The Great Heroin Coup as running the Spanish intelligence service, the DGS, virtually single-handedly. Again, the Nazi International in Madrid, the Nazi government in exile, or the Nazi party organization in exile, much again as Kurt Ries had projected in 44. Now, resuming again T.H. Tetten's text here. The Washington Post of May 6, 1956, reported on the close contacts between right-wing radicals in Germany and the center of the Nazi International in Madrid. Observers in Bonn have traced the increasing activity of former Nazis who travel between Germany and the main centers of the International, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Egypt, and Argentina. They often work for import-export firms and agencies and for German motor manufacturers. they are able to tap, quote, buried, unquote, Nazi assets abroad, which may be providing the main financial backing for nationalist activities inside Germany. The names most frequently in the news in connection with the underground work of the Madrid Nazi Center are the anti-Semitic, rabble-rousing Dr. Johann von Leers, L-E-E-R-S, the SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, S-K-O-R-Z-E-N-Y, and the German Luftwaffe ace Hans Ulrich Rudel, R-U-D-E-L. It is a well-known fact that Franco has taken the Nazi plotters to his bosom. When in 1959 a delegation of the Nazi Condor Legion visited Madrid, Franco greeted his old Civil War allies with the words, quote, "Please regard Spain as your second fatherland," unquote. Note that Otto Skorzeny became a key Galen agent after World War II, including the period when Galen was working for the CIA. By the way, the Nazi Condor Legion was a group of Luftwaffe aviators who fought on behalf of Franco's forces during the Spanish Civil War. Now, bear in mind something that we took a look at in Radio Free America program number 3, and that we came back to, touched back on in number 4, and came back to in a big way in Radio Free America program number 22, as well as a miscellaneous archive show about the fascist third position. One of the Galen operations that we looked at was a 1952 operation in which a number of Nazi war criminals under Otto Skorzeny, again, one of the key activists in the post-World War II Nazi underground here, again with headquarters in Madrid, the Nazi Party in Exile. One of the things that Skorzeny was involved with on behalf of Galen working for CIA and Allen Dulles was to bring a bunch of former German military officers, many of them SS veterans, Gestapo veterans, and war criminals, to put together the Egyptian General Staff and the Egyptian Intelligence Service. This projected many of these people into Middle East activities. Now, this was a Galen operation. What we're going to take a look at next is the activities of this Madrid underground, and we will see the dovetailing of these activities with some of the same elements that we saw in Radio Free America programs 3 and 22, that Galen-Skorzeny Middle East operation. In January of 1952, German and Swiss papers reported an extraordinary concentration of former high SS officers and ex-Nazi officials in Cairo. They were in close contact with influential Egyptian army officers and with the fanatical Arab plotter and Hitler's friend Haji Amin al-Husseini, the ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. By the way, that's H-A-J-A-M-I-N-E-L-H-U-S-S-E-I-N-I. The Basler Nachrichten of January 29, 1952, mentioned the former Nazi SS Colonel Dolman as one of those who had conferences with the Egyptian plotters in the Grand Mufti's headquarters via Aida in Heliopolis, a suburb outside of Cairo. The papers hinted that it was Dolman and his co-conspirators in Madrid who had set the fuse of an anti-British plot in Cairo, which a few months later resulted in the explosion that ended with the ousting of King Farouk. By the way, Basler Nachrichten, B-A-S-L-E-R-N-A-C-H-R-I-C-H-T-E-N, that, of course, from Basel, Switzerland. In any event, note that after King Farouk was ousted, according to this paper at least, in part as a result of the Grand Mufti himself, a former SS officer, plotting with this exile Third Reich contingent, King Farouk was ousted. He was succeeded by Gamal Abdel Nasser himself, like Anwar Sadat, a former German spy during World War II, and it was the Nasser government that was aided by the Galen Skorzeny CIA contingent that we discussed in RFAs 3 and 22. Now, of the handling of the Dolman case, here it's reminiscent of the way the Naumann plotters themselves were handled. Reading again from T.H. Tettens, although the local police regarded the Dolman arrest as, quote, of great importance, unquote, someone in a high position in Bonn must have judged the affair from quite a different point of view, almost as an unfortunate accident that had to be remedied as quickly as possible. Despite the fact that the German law punishes the forging of passports and the use of false documents with long prison terms, Herr Dolman did not suffer any great inconvenience. He might have been released without any trial had not the Frankfurter Rundschau given the case considerable publicity. Under these circumstances, Dolman appeared before a lower magistrate's court a week after his arrest and was sentenced to 2 months' imprisonment for forgery. The mild sentence given to Dolman, the pressures to quash the prosecution against the Naumann plotters, the toleration of the activities of such important Nazis as Colonel Skorzeny and Hans Ulrich Rudel, gave rise to the suspicion that high officials in Bonn had some secret ties with the Nazi center in Madrid. What we're going to take a look at is these not-so-secret Nazi ties. I misestimated the amount of time this program would take this evening, otherwise I would have gone into the Adenauer government. We've touched on that briefly, but we're going to go back and we're going to take a look at the degree of success that the Nazi underground was able to achieve, and we will be coming back to this and take a look in detail at the many ministers under Konrad Adenauer next week.